Hello and welcome back to the EV Cafe Takeaway, that podcast that is focused on that zero emission future that we all hope for. Every week I'm joined by one of the wonderful members of the team of the EV Cafe, and this week is no exception. I have the lovely, the inimitable, if I could say the word, John Curtis.
Greetings, darling. Are you well?
I'm very well. And for those of us, and we'll introduce our guest in just a second, but we're hats. We're donning hats. So indeed, if you want to get over to YouTube, go and check out our hats. John is a legend. But actually, we have a true legend. We have an innovator, a pioneer, a collaborator in the wonderful Chris Hazel. I'm always wanting to call you Chris Felton, but because Felton is the company that you co-founded and are CEO of. Chris, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
It's our pleasure. Now, you've forced us into wearing hats.
Forced is a bit strong.
Look, we're all getting old and we're all losing our hair, so hats are becoming a more common situation, I think, these days.
How true.
This is true. But we are donning hats today on a ridiculously warm day. Anyway, but there we go. So if it's cold where you are, it obviously isn't today that we recorded this. But anyway, so Chris, I'm actually genuinely quite excited to have you on. We are excited for all of our guests, but you're doing a lot in our space. Very innovative, very creative, and quite exciting. And you know, today we want to cover off a lot of the things that you've been involved in. I mean, and we will get to them a little bit later. Things like driving around London with an easy chair. What would you call it? A comfort chair? Easy chair?
Those ones that really old people have.
Yes,
like help you
an
up
old
when
people
you
chair. Oh, that's right. Yeah, on top of a mini and being surrounded by the anti-terrorist police. Yeah. But anyway, we'll come on to that in a bit. And you've done some amazing stuff with vans.
Yeah, you love the vans, don't you?
Van, which I do love a van. I do love a van. But you know, in terms of innovation, and in particular, a lot of our audience are in the business-to-business world, are, you know, fleets, larger fleets, dealing with the challenge of electrification. And this is something you've dedicated a lot of your career to. But I know that, you know, there's something just coming out as we speak that is really relevant to our audience and to the challenge of charging. Give us first a little bit of an introduction about you, but then if you can just kind of step into that for us, just to give us some context around how you solve problems.
Yes. So, as you said, I'm Chris Hazel, CEO, co-founder of Felton. We were called Zero EV in the beginning, and then we rebranded 2 years ago, just because EVs were becoming commonplace and everyone was having EV in their name. So I figured in the future, people are going to look at us and be like, everything's EV. Why have you got EV in your name? But, you know, you guys have EV in your name, so it's still relevant to an extent.
The EV Cafe, he says, pointing to it rather largely.
It'll just be known as the Cafe.
Thanks, Chris, for destroying our name on air.
Well done. You're known as a cafe, but you never have tea and coffee at your events.
Chris, where did Felton come from?
So Felton is Welsh for lightning. So it has some relevance. Obviously, none of us are actually Welsh. But we're pretty close to Wales. So it had to be something that had a base meaning, but something we could build a brand from.
Indeed.
So Felton was one of those ones. If you search it, it's only us that comes up. Whereas with Zero EV, there was so much that came up when you search the word zero in EV these days.
Right.
So it was trying to step away from that and do that rebrand. And the reason being is we started transitioning from doing EV retrofit and conversions to more looking at larger volume, high voltage battery packs, energy storage systems. So we had to make that move across to become a bit more of a corporate business. Obviously, as you alluded to earlier, I still have my YouTube channel doing stupid stuff separate to the business now, which we'll come to later because we've done some interesting projects recently. But yeah, the core thing of the Felton brand now and the business is high voltage battery packs production for retrofit classic cars, but also boats, to allow boats to transition to EV because they're actually pretty bad at polluting. The amount of stuff they pump into the water is not great, and then fuel spills are not great. So getting marine to move across to electric is a really big deal that we've been heavily involved with recently with a couple of very big players in the market. But the big thing we've been doing recently, alongside, obviously, I've got the arrival vans, started playing with those, as I'm sure we'll come on to later. But that got us moving in a different direction around fleet. So we were like, what can we actually do that will make a fundamental difference environmentally? And looking at the market, you go, well, everyone's put their focus on passenger vehicles, which sit parked up probably over 99% of their time. Yet the vehicles that are actually out on the road doing hundreds of thousands of miles are still diesel and still petrol. It just seemed a little bit wrong in my head that it seems like we've focused in the wrong area. And actually, it seems this year, going to some of the shows, it's become quite apparent that suddenly fleet has stepped up the game. The batteries are getting bigger in the vans. The charging speed's getting better. It's suddenly become more viable for fleet to go electric. And the cost point's coming down.
Chris, if I may, can I just define, you've mentioned fleet and you've kind of alluded to like the commercial vehicle sector. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, so mainly commercial vehicle sector. So vans, basically, delivery vehicles. There's more and more on the road. There's so much, you know, everyone's doing more and more delivery. It's only going to increase. So the focus now is we've sort of looked at the market closely and gone, why isn't someone doing what we're now doing? Which is taking second life batteries being the key thing. Because if you look at the available second life battery market, it's doubled every single year for the last 6 or 7 years. So we're now getting into thousands of second life batteries available a year rather than, you know, tens or hundreds previously. So we've taking second life batteries, so not brand new batteries, meaning we take them out of a written off Tesla or a high mileage Tesla that's on, say, 200,000 miles. Put it into an energy storage box to then have another 15 to 20 years of life. So suddenly that's really good for the environment, circular economy.
Hang on a second. You can't take batteries out of a vehicle because they're rubbish. As soon as it gets to, you know, crashed or it's done 200,000 miles, those batteries are garbage. They just need throwing on a tip and you can't use them. Utter garbage.
Which is what we get from everyone outside the industry that has no idea around batteries. I think most of these cars, we're seeing Teslas now on 200,000 miles, they've still got 80% of their battery capacity. Still there.
Wow.
And it's like, what, no one wants to carry on driving the car because the car's a bit tired at that point, you know, wear and tear. People still have this weird thing in the head that 200,000 miles means the car is done. In an EV world, it's actually not. It can probably do 400, 500, 600,000 miles, but there's still that's an embedded sort of thing from having diesel and petrol cars for a number of years. So we're taking those batteries, putting them into energy storage, which means we're giving them that second life. They're not having to go for recycling. Also, they're cost effective at that point because they've been used. It means we can pick them up at a fairly sensible price. And from an energy storage point of view, they are crazy high grade. I mean, they've done so much testing, these OEMs, to make sure they last as long as possible. They cope with vibration, you know, water ingress. The battery management systems are extremely advanced on them. Way more advanced than you normally see in the energy storage space because they're A-grade batteries. A lot of energy storage batteries are sort of B, C-grade batteries that don't quite meet the mark. So they're normally a slightly lower grade for energy storage because they have an easier life. Hmm. So we're basically building stuff with second life batteries, but actually they're a lot higher quality because they're OEM batteries. And I should probably get onto why we're doing this and how it actually works. I've just spoken about storing batteries and use batteries for people, which is exciting to me, but may not be to everyone else. So the key thing is we've basically developed a new product called Charge Cube, and that's cube with a Q, which is a 10-foot sea container that has up to 6 Tesla batteries inside of it, so up to 450 kilowatt hours. But the key thing is that it's not just a box with batteries in. We've spent the time developing the power electronics to make them boxes that can charge stuff. So we can have CCS rapid charging built into these boxes. So each 10-foot container can have 2 CCS rapid chargers built into it that can do either 120 kilowatt each or 240 kilowatt output if you use a single one of the guns at a time. So you've got really good charging speed for fleets and stuff. But the key thing is they've also got additional connectors in the side, so you can have these pavilions. So they're like, it looks like a miniature container on end, and we've got 2 chargers on them. And then basically you can have up to, I think it's 8 of those coming out of the charge cube. So you put it in a car parking space and you have these pavilions that come out. Then you've got all your 7 kilowatt type 2 chargers on these sort of standalone units that plug into the main container. Now, I suppose I should probably explain, why is this a thing? Why can't someone just go and pay to have some infrastructure put in? Well, most people like us don't own their premises. So you go and spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on your premises, you don't own it. So you've just given all that money to the landlord, or you've got to take it out when you leave, which is not great. You tend not to have enough power. As soon as you go and bring a big fleet in, it's like, well, do I have to pay hundreds of thousands of pounds to have the grid supply increased and all this stuff? So what we've been doing is looking at it going, well, we can probably buffer that with batteries. Most locations have enough power for a fleet of vans. They just don't have enough power at a given point in time to charge all of them at once. But if you can charge up the batteries 24 hours a day, and then you want to discharge those batteries for 6 hours, you've got enough because you've collected it throughout the day into the batteries, or you've put solar on the roof, which normally pays back in about 3 years now, to feed into the cube as well. So suddenly you've got this item that you can drop in, you can potentially buy or lease it over like a 5 year period. So it's all maintained for you. But the key thing is you feed your grid in, you have available, it manages all your charging. You can install it in a day. So it's super quick to install. You can take it with you if you move location, but also you don't have to upgrade your power supply. So you just take whatever you've got, whether it's 32 amp three phase or 63 amp three phase available, and just feed that into the battery basically. And that then allows you to charge your fleet whenever you need to, but also not have to upgrade your grid supply.
Wow. Which, I mean, you know, let's be honest, Chris, the upgrading of the grid supply is where the wheels seem to come off a little bit for so many of the companies that we're talking to. You know, a lot of the fleets are recognizing that they need to create hubs for fast charging, but they need to be in control of them, because, you know, take a fleet that typically will go home. They will spend some time in one or other of their depots at different times, but they won't necessarily have the dwell time that we've become accustomed to of overnight or 10 or 12 hours or whatever it is, but they need that instant stuff. And it sounds like to me that you're giving the opportunity, and I mean, I don't know how you amortize the cost and what sort of costs we might be talking about here, but how you can drop in and charge those vehicles and get them out on the road and deal with that big challenge of getting power into those vehicles. That's critical. And it sounds like you're really solving a problem there. What sort of cost are we talking about?
So you're varying. So our smallest unit start at 62,000. So that is 150 kilowatt hours of battery, six type 2 right. chargers on the pavilions, as a standalone drop-in mm-hmm. unit with the battery buffer. And then we range up to just over 200,000 when we get to the 450 kilowatt hour, you know, 8 pavilions CCS rapid charging built.
And so what is that? So for a fleet that is kind of dropping that kind of solution in, let's take the big expensive one with a couple of, you know, rapid chargers and you know, 8 or so based on, and we can easily do the maths on those, but what's the sort of payback period when we think, well, you know, in comparison to what else we can do, or if we incorporate solar and all of that kind of stuff? I guess you've done the maths on that.
Yeah,
and,
so, you know, if we incorporate things like solar, the payback works out roughly around 3.5 years, but that's fully paid back based on the fact that you're using solar, or you're charging when electric's cheap and you're using it, say, in the day when electric's really expensive. Mm. But also, yeah, we're saying that payback's 3.5 years, but that includes all your charging infrastructure. Whereas normally you would have to pay to install your charging infrastructure, which you wouldn't also have batteries.
Absolutely.
So when you look at it from that point of view, you're actually getting all your infrastructure in place with battery energy storage, and you're pretty much covering yourself for 3.5 years.
And you mentioned that it doesn't necessarily need to be OPEX. It doesn't necessarily need to be CAPEX. It could be OPEX. So you could wrap this into an operational lease, or some kind of function with the maintenance, with everything like that. So you've got those sort of agreements set up already.
Yeah, so that's what we've been working with a couple of different companies around that, a couple of different banks and leasing sort of companies to basically say, like, we want to offer this on a 5-year lease, which includes full support, maintenance, service, all that stuff. And then in theory, they can just release it 5 years later. So that's the plan. I think in most situations, the lease works, because the ideal world is you go and lease 12 vans and you also lease a charge cube as part of a package you would do. And the charge cube may be a little bit more expensive than that van is per month. But the ideal point of view is trying to get the price of the charge cube somewhere where you've got 12 vans and your 13th or 14th van is the cube. you just have this monthly outgoing.
Yeah.
We're also doing some really clever stuff with the software. So we're doing like an intelligent energy management system to manage the chargers and then manage the fleet to go, well, this van is on, you know, tomorrow this van's doing 200 miles, but this one's only doing 100. Well, I need to decide how much power goes into each van. So we're adding in like a really clever system that can track the vans for the fleet operators and go, well, that van needs that much power tomorrow, that needs that much power. I'm going to choose how much power to put into each van to manage the power availability on site. Because you might get to that point where you're very close to your power limit, but you'll have some of your fleet that are doing shorter journeys, some that are doing longer. So you can then be clever around which ones do you charge up faster than others and things like that.
Stuff.
He's no average bear, is he? Good grief. Now then, Chris, I'm fascinated by this. How on earth are you so good at solving this kind of problem? Are you an engineer by training? What's your background?
So I've had a very weird background, basically.
So good.
My family are all aircraft engineers, so most of the family has come from aerospace over the years. I was the one that rebelled and went, no, I'm going to go and do art and design.
Of course.
Yeah. Admittedly, I mean, I'm severely dyslexic. I wanted to do physics and chemistry at university. I couldn't get in. I just wasn't. Went back when I was younger, that was not an option with my dyslexia. Now, I think very different. The support's different. So I went art and design route, but then I moved into stage lighting, robotic lighting. So I did loads in the stage lighting world, event world for years. And then I moved into high power generators for Aggreko. So I was did the Olympic Games with Aggreko, doing service management for them. So running their engineers and their fleets. So I had 650 diesel generators running for the Olympic Games. But I spent a couple of years in that world doing temporary installation, big power generators, and also ice rinks, which is very random. So summer used to be generators event world. Winter was generators, but cooling systems for ice rinks. So two extremes. But it basically meant I was involved in the sort of the event world, the rental world, the generator, high power world. And tied into that, I was always doing automotive stuff, like tinkering on cars, rebuilding cars, that sort of stuff. So I exited that world into rental. So from rental into ramp rental, which is really weird. So I actually had a company called Ramp It Up, and we used to rent ramps with tools and train people how to do repair work on their own cars. They'd rent the ramp for the hour with the tools, and they'd come and do their own work. Brilliant idea in theory, but anyone that comes and rents a ramp to do their own work hasn't got any money because they're trying to save money by renting a ramp. So that idea didn't work, but I learned loads over that two-year period, actually, of how to run a business. I met loads of amazing people, learned about all the training and all that sort of stuff. And then I started building my electric Skyline after I exited that company, which is my fun thing on the side, which has led into this sort of route, I suppose.
A Skyline.
Ooh. Chris, sounds exciting, doesn't it? I'm fascinated about what you've done, but I'm also really curious as to why you've done it. So what I mean by that is that, you know, we make choices, right? And so I understand how you got to art and design and then, you know, maybe fell into the robotics, because that sounds really interesting and exciting. But then you've kind of developed this mindset of wanting to do it for yourself. Like, you've gone into business, you come up with this ramp idea, obviously Felton now, and as was Zero EV or whatever it was called before. Why do you want to be in business for yourself? What has sort of triggered that kind of mindset?
I think when you're younger, you get held back a lot by big companies. So you want to do more, you want to grow, but normally they, in the corporate world, they have their set process. You can't move forward quickly. You can't learn as quick as you want to learn. So by going and doing your own thing, is you're not held back by any of that. You're only held back by yourself. So for me, I like hyper-focusing and learning new things and jumping in at the deep end. Which is why I started doing my own business stuff. Plus, I'm probably an awful person to employ, to be perfectly honest. The position I'm in now is great because I can jump between multiple tasks. So I can jump in and out of different teams with different engineers or a fabrication department and spend an hour here, hour there, which works really well for the way my mind works. But if you went and sat me in a place and went, you need to do this job continually, day in, day out, but it just doesn't work for me. So I thrive in the area where I'm in as a CEO because I get to jump between different tasks and I can manage multiple products at one point in time, which just suits the way my mind works, which I tend to find with a lot of my engineers as well, is actually that I give them multiple projects because they get bored. So they'll do one thing for a day, but the next day they'll be on a different project because they like jumping between tasks, mainly because most of the staff that work for me are neurodiverse and none of us are classed as normal at any level. But we get loads of stuff done and we come up with some really cool ideas. But why I do it, I originally, when we started it, wanted to build like high performance cars. And I wanted to do something that was different. Everyone had done twin turbo kits. Everyone had done superchargers. It was like, well, what's left in the automotive world? EV was exciting, different, and no one was doing it. It was like, I want to play with electric stuff. And it's that cool thing. It was that mix between cars and tech. So you had the two really big interests of mine, which is cars and tech, and you got to put the two together. So I think that kept it really exciting. But then you sort of started, as I got older, I think, and I started seeing the environmental side of things, my mindset started changing over more of actually, well, I think as you get older, you go, well, what am I leaving behind? Am I leaving the world in a better place than I started or not? I think that's an age thing, though. I don't think that's, when you're younger, you do not care. You're like, I'm going to do a new burnout. I'm going to burn petrol.
Unless you're Greta Thunberg, honestly, of course.
Unless you're Greta Thunberg. But as you get older, I think you start appreciating the environment more. And I think COVID had a big change on people as well, because it made everyone step back and go, what are we actually doing? And suddenly, obviously, everything cleared up. You know, they had dolphins swim through Venice. Like, they had all these weird things that happened. And it was like, we're actually having a massive impact here. How do we actually make a difference? So I think COVID really made me stop and go, yeah, maybe we should do something a little bit better for the environment, not just building cool things. At that point, we couldn't do ChargeCube because there wasn't enough second life batteries and doing new stuff was way too expensive to allow it people to actually do it. But suddenly the time has now become right. Like, we actually developed the first ChargeCube 5 years ago, but we couldn't make it cost effectively. It just, there was no way of making it cost effective. Everything was low voltage.
Scale it because of the the value.
Back then we were always taking Tesla packs apart. So what we've done over the last couple of years beforehand is we've reverse engineered all the OEM systems. So we know how to make a Tesla battery pack live without it being in the car. We've developed all that software to control it. So over that time period, we were still building towards ChargeCube, I suppose, just unknowingly, as we started developing those products for the retrofit world.
Incredible.
I'm recently diagnosed, Chris, as neurodivergent. I've got autism and ADHD. And I only found out about that 6 months ago, and it opened my eyes to who I really am and that I do fit in, just not in some people's world. How long have you known that you were neurodivergent and different, and how has that either enabled you or disabled you?
So I was statemented when I was 10 years old as being dyslexic.
Right.
So I was right at the beginning. What frustrated me is you'd go to school and people would be like, oh, I'm dyslexic. I'm like, are you really? That would be the next buzzword that people would use to get out of doing stuff. Even though they weren't statemented, they hadn't been diagnosed. Whereas I'd actually been diagnosed, gone through it. So for me, I always felt held back heavily, especially at school.
Yeah.
Like, I did really well at science and maths, but I did really bad at English. So it would keep me in lower sets because I had to be in a specific set for English. So it held me back in all the other areas. Now, suddenly, with the uptake of AI, suddenly being neurodiverse actually is becoming a humongous benefit because you think about the world differently. You approach things differently. And with the new AI stuff, the systems you're working with can move as fast as your mind works, which is, I know it sounds weird, but I always felt like I could get more done if I could find a way to help me. And I think that's the key thing, is with the new technology coming out now, if you're neurodiverse, suddenly you can do way more and move forward. I think one thing we need to look at is we need to look back hundreds of years. Everyone suddenly went to this academic system of you need to learn to read and write. Hundreds of years ago, you had scholars for that specifically. No one else read and wrote. So actually, you are not, in my head, neurodiverse is not really a real thing. I know that's going to sound weird, but I think neurodiversity is just normal. And the way the systems develop, it suddenly made you a different person. Where if you looked back hundreds and hundreds of years, everyone was neurodiverse to some level. Yep. And everyone is. They've just labeled
Chris,
it.
I think you've hit a nail on the head there. And, so if I was to consider my life, right, I'm, from a child, I was the horror story, loads of... Everything was wrong. I was in.
You've just won the internet, my friend.
I'm coming for you. But Not a lot is the truth. But this is it. We don't change, right? So we learn how to manage it. So, like, you know, dyslexia, has it changed? No, but you've learned how to manage it. And, you know, whatever it is, I'm not diagnosed. I've never done that. I've had lots of counselling, but not been told that I'm ADHD, which I probably am. I don't, you know, but
highly likely.
What this kind of led...
Let's go with yes.
But what it told me was that it's called a spectrum for a reason, right? Mm. We're all somewhere along it. And yes, there are some people that are thoroughly disabled by autism, you know, and it is, like, you know, quite obvious. It's completely impossible for those to... But when I look back over time and I make assumptions, because some of the greatest people that have done some amazing things, and I think of our communities now, are absolutely clearly ADHD or, you know, or autistic to some degree. We know people within our community. Michael speaks, I've forgotten his surname just for the minute, John, but you'd know him.
Barton.
Mike,
Barton.
Yeah. Mike Barton. He speaks on it, but he's an analyst. And you think, you know, probably Socrates or all of those were guys that just kind of could only kind of focus on one thing and just had to, you know, but then they brought out genius. And I think that's the thing. We've got to get to a place of acceptance with all of this, that we're all different. We all do things differently in a different way. And it's once we get that ability to go down our own road that we become the best that we can be. You know, we don't all become CEOs and founders, but we become the best that we can be. And it sounds like you've created a place within Felton that is a positive place where people can become the best. Mm. And you're using AI to help that. Talk to me a little bit about your company and all of that and how you've kind of taken the knowledge and used it wisely.
So I have probably a very odd management technique, which some people struggle with that come into the company because they're trained in a very specific way how to manage and structure. But for me, it's all about the culture of the staff and the team I have here and then how they work together. So, like, my software hardware engineers, my head of software, like, he's the best software engineer I've come across. And I've worked with loads over the years. I don't want to offend anyone that used to work with me, but he's pretty good. but I've known him for years.
Counseling is available if you've been affected by this.
I brought him in from repairing iPhones. His experience was playing with Arduinos at home. Never did anything in software world. He is phenomenal at software, but I managed to get him into a place where he's constantly learning. So I load him up just enough that he's always learning. So I never let him have a drop off. And it keeps your mind in a very specific point. So you're just continually getting better and better and better, but also also how to plant the seed with a certain, because I am neurodiverse and like my brother Nick's ADHD. So we've grown up sort of very similar. You know how to manage people, but neurodiverse people in a very different way. And I think I take it for granted, but I've learned how to manage them. And it means that now, because I'm the same, like what works for me tends to work for them. That you can get the best out of them. You can get loads done. Trying to get something finished is normally the difficult bit because they'll get to a point and then be like, yeah, it's boring now. I'm going to go and do this, which I'm just as bad. So trying to get the last bit over the line. So that's where you have to have a mix of different neurodiverse people. The ones that are bit more like slightly more autistic. So they want to see something right through to the end and make sure it's 100% perfect. Then you also have the ones at the beginning that are super excited to get it to a really good point. They get 80% there and then lose interest. So you just need to know when the swap over point is to go, you've done this design, but you don't want to do the drawings to go with it. Right, we've got someone else that's happy to just do the drawings. So it's knowing you need to just accept that chances are if you have someone that's neurodiverse, they will get loads done quickly and it will be amazing, but they won't finish it. So depending on the type of neurodiversity they've got, you need the right person then to work alongside them to take it over the line. So it's just managing that. And I think it's an ever-changing world. Because I am neurodiverse, I understand it. But I think you get a lot of people in a lot of positions that have been trained in a specific way. So they're very rigid on their mindset and they don't know how to deal with it. So they just put neurodiverse people as broken in a way, or they don't fit within a business. They shouldn't be in a big corporation, but they work amazing in the startup world and the low business world, providing the small business world, providing you know how to manage them. And you can get some amazing results, which, you know, we've got 30 people here, but the amount of stuff we turn out, the amount of stuff we develop compared to other companies is actually crazy. I think we should do stuff faster, but actually we get a lot done with a little amount of staff, which is interesting.
It's like X-Men. Do you know what I mean? We've all got our. You must be. What's his name? Xavier. What is the boss?
the guy that's in the wheelchair.
Yes.
Cry me a river.
Cry me a river. For those of you not on YouTube, the hats came off and there was not a lot of hair. Oh, dear.
We just took a beard instead.
Well, that's it. That's why I grew a beard, because I couldn't. It's all gone south. It just, I mean, you know,
no, just stop that, please.
My chest. But Chris, I mean, clearly with all of this, so we've got the business, and we the Charge Cube makes sense for fleets and all of that sort of stuff. Mm. But alongside of this, you do seem to be having a little bit of fun. Some would argue maybe too much, especially at my expense. But anyway, but YouTube is something, and for those of you that don't know, Hazelnuts, what a brilliant name. What a brilliant name. I love that. And learning about you, it kind of says a bit more about Hazelnuts, you know, just slightly nuts, but in a completely beautiful way. But you've had a lot of success with it. And, what's been the biggest kind of video that you've done? What's been the favourite one that you've done? And then you must tell us about Mr. Bean, whether it's your favourite or not, I don't know. But you must tell us about the Mr. Bean video. So, you know, a big channel, 74,000 followers, nearly 75,000 followers. So go and follow it. And you know, I mean, that's impressive. We could do some of those on coming over onto the Evie Cafe channel. Come on, you know, some of Chris's followers. But what's your biggest video? What's the best video or favourite video? And what about Mr. Bean? Tell us that story.
So Hazelnuts... I've done the YouTube stuff because I had to be very corporate in my Felton world, shall we say. Right. So if you look at my Felton stuff, it's a very certain way, corporate. We've got to be a certain way. But what I found over the years is actually the YouTube was a really good way of bringing in work to the business, because the engineers would watch a YouTube channel and they would then push it up to management to come to us. So we were focused heavily on the engineering level, because they're the ones that actually, they don't make the finished decision, but if the engineers are happy and they love it, they want to be involved in it, they'll push it from that point of view. So videos-wise, the arrival video, the first one's done extremely well. That was just a very much off the cuff. Bought a van, didn't think I was going to be able to film there at all on that day. I thought it was going to be pick it up, that's it. I walked in and the guy's like, yeah, do what you want. So we just had free reign for the whole day in the warehouse, just wandering around, and they were great. Like the auction people were just like, yeah, just do what you want for the day. And we just wandered around for the whole day filming. And they just left us to it, which I was amazed that was what happened. But it meant we produced basically a really good video out of that. And we showed people in the back, you know, behind the scenes of arrival and all that stuff with those vans. And obviously since then, I've started taking them apart just so people could see how they were built. Now, I haven't been the nicest about it, because arrival did frustrate me massively, because they had all this potential, all this money, all this backing, and then it just was poorly managed and executed to actually become a product. And it just seemed to me like a massive waste of time and energy, because there were so many amazing engineers there, and it just didn't get to where it needed to get to, because they're once again, probably loads of amazing neurodiverse people, but no one managing it to the right way to get the finished product out. It was always, it could be better, it could be better. Well, at some point you've got to release something and then iterate on it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you never release anything at all.
Yeah.
You have to release a product, even if it's not quite perfect, and then add to it. So yeah, the arrival video has done amazingly well. The first videos I actually did were the MX5 video. So that was over lockdown, where I was still allowed to be in the workshop, because we were sort of classed as a mechanic shop. So I still worked the whole way through lockdown, but I did the MX5. So we did an MX5 start to finish as electric. That's what got a huge amount of our subscriber base over the line to start with. And then we sort of stopped for a while because the business got in the way. So I stepped back, I stopped doing YouTube stuff. And then obviously as the business now got bigger, more staff, more corporate, I was like, I really need an outlet for sort of me and my younger brother, Nick, to have a bit of fun, do something that's not tied into Felton. But it indirectly feeds into the business because we're always playing around with products which we build at Felton, obviously. And now we're doing a couple of stupid builds in that we're going to rebuild the arrival van. I actually have my logbook now for the van, which is amazing. Not that it drives, but I have a logbook for it. So I managed to get that sorted. So in theory, it can go on the road, but I need to actually get it to drive. So the plan is we'll rebuild that with a Tesla Model 3 system in it. And then I know it can be used day in, day out reliably. I've got the van build I'm doing at the moment from the T5 van with the Tesla chassis that I've been trying to fit the van body over this Tesla chassis. Spoiler, it isn't going to fit. You'll find that out in the next video coming. So it looks like I'm going back to how I used to build stuff, which is build a subframe into the van, put a battery pack under the floor of the van and do a bit more of a classic conversion, which actually people will probably enjoy. And then the Tesla chassis I have is actually going to become something rather special, which I'm not going to tell you yet. But a wide body low thing, something a little bit special is going to happen to that, which will be quite funny to see on the road long term. But yeah, we've ended up going from one project to two projects and the arrival van on top of that. So I've never got enough hours in the day, but it's fun. One day a week I'll spend doing YouTube stuff, just trying to get videos out for people to something they can enjoy. That's a little bit more me outside of work rather than the corporate sort of approach I have to take in work.
Chris, are you somebody that likes routine or hates routine?
I like routine it's probably a mid-level in that I have to have a set routine in the day. What happens in the day floats around, but it's more of the lines of I like to know that I get up at a set time every morning, go to the gym, certain breakfast, always stop at a certain type of lunch. So I have a level of routine, but that's more that was more my way of managing my neurodiversity. And you'll find a lot of people with ADHD. One thing I found as I've got older, my traits have altered because I've learned to manage certain things, but I've allowed certain things to sort of not step back, but in school, you're very much pigeonholed into a certain way and your thinking is a certain way. But as I've got older, I've been trying to just relax that a lot. So my dyslexia has come out more in some ways as I've got older. My level of ADHD that's mixed in with it's come out in more ways because I'm not suppressing it anymore. But the routine is my key thing. I have to have a set routine to keep me focused to some level, because without that routine, it just becomes absolute bedlam. But my wife, normally Stevie, she's the one that keeps me in my routine, keeps me organized. She's autistic, and so she's sort of planned, organized in a way, which makes me planned and organized to a certain level. So that keeps me on track.
Time for her? How you mentioned time earlier, and you've got so much going on in your life. How do you focus on the priorities for you? And Stevie, you know, giving you that framework is clearly an important part of your world.
So for me, I don't have kids, which is great. we don't have kids, which actually means that we have a sausage dog called Slinky. But apart from that, we don't have kids. So there's definitely more time available, obviously. Normally for me, it'll be sort of up at 6 a.m. I'll, you know, go to the gym, go to work. One big thing I found with the gym in the morning, biggest difference. Like since I started doing that a year and a half ago now, it just completely changes your mindset for the day. It really does just clear the mind, gives me that bit of time just for like that 40 odd minutes just to refocus for the day. So I go into the office sort of understanding what I'm doing for the day rather than going to the office and trying to work out what the hell I'm doing that day. It's a big deal. Then I'll work to say 5 or 6 o'clock at night. Normally my one rule is that I always put down my laptop at 9 p.m. no matter what. So my cutoff is 9 p.m. every night. So if I've got work or not, 9 p.m. is the cutoff, and then I can sit and watch Netflix with Stevie and stuff. Even though when I'm sat watching Netflix, I'm wasting time. I could be doing other stuff. I think I've sort of learned. I've gone, I have to have 8 hours of sleep, and I have to shut off at a certain time at night. Otherwise, you'll just burn out. So it's trying to get that balance right. Normally, I'll always film on a Saturday, but Sunday I will do editing and just chill out. So I'm still doing work on editing videos, but I'm sat, I'm relaxed, doing bits of work around the house, all of that sort of stuff. So time is always tight, but it's all about what you don't do more than what you do is what I'm finding.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what I can give to other people to do.
Are you happy? You know, we talk to a lot of people who give the they present that they are happy people, very confident, capable, and doing stuff. You actually seem to have a real inner contentment about where you are in life. Are you happy?
I don't think anyone's truly happy. Like, realistically, everyone's always got, no matter what you're doing, there's always something that you're not happy about. Life is never perfect. And anyone that tells you that their life is perfect, it isn't. Even the most wealthiest people in the world with the most things have still got things they wish they'd done or wish they were doing. So in one way, I suppose, yeah, I'm happy in that I've got, you know, I've got a good family there. I've got a great team of staff, but I always feel that we could get more done and do more, which is what holds me back. But that will change soon because we're just raising money on an investment round at the moment. So we'll have funding soon, which we haven't had before, to actually be able to grow quicker. That's exciting for me. Like, I'm going through all the stress now of how the hell do you raise money? How do you do all this stuff? Dealing with investors. That's one thing I've struggled with heavily recently that people don't tell you when you get into investment is the level of disappointment and the level of rejection. It brings me back to when I was sort of at school going, you're not good enough to do this. Yeah. You're not capable of doing it. You're not going to be able to do anything with your life, sort of thing. You get back to that weird mindset of, well, maybe if I'm not good enough, what if the business isn't good enough? What if the business isn't doing the right things? Because you get so much rejection when it comes to investment. Yeah. You'll send an investment deck out to hundreds of people and like a couple will reply. And you'll have a couple of great meetings and they'll have a meeting which is great. The next email is, yeah, we're not interested. And I'm like, but so it's just loads of, that is hard. I don't think trying to get yourself to cope with that is really difficult because it's just rejection after rejection. I mean, the best way to look at it, I think, for a lot of people is, for me, what else would I be doing with myself if I wasn't in this situation? I'd be working nine to five for someone else. Actually, I'm not working for someone else. I'm doing what I want to do whenever I want to do it. And I think that's sort of the way to look at it is, I'm happy in the fact that I'm able to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And I think the main thing that I've done over the years is find enjoyment in others, in that if my staff do well, if my staff achieve something, that's the bit I think you've got to thrive on, is them and doing things for them to make their life better. There's a sort of a weird emotion that comes with that, which is so odd to explain, but also crazy fulfilling at the same time. My little sister Annie heads up our development team, and just seeing her progress and do more, manage that team, grow with it. It's not a financial thing. It's an odd emotional thing, which you cannot explain. But I think that's what I end up doing for. I end up doing a lot of this for the people, not for, let's say, there's the environmental benefits, but a lot of it's for the team and the people I work with, not the rest of it, which is odd.
It's all about the people.
It really is.
The people. Yeah.
Which I never thought I'd say
that
years ago.
The things that you could... the things that you can control, though, isn't it, really, in a sense, that you can give people opportunity, you can give people the ability, but you can support them to be the best that they can be, and then that's kind of fulfilling. I was working with a CEO last year, and he always would speak about this permanent state of discontent that was his engine room. You know, this kind of, and I suppose actually the sort of easiest thing to do is to kind of just rest on your laurels or do that sort of stuff. And, you know, you turn up, you do a job, you go home. There's no, because I mean, I used to, and to your point earlier about the corporate world, I used to go into my day job at LeasePlan, and I would sit there moaning, just, you know, grumbling about this problem and that problem. Why did we do that? Why did we do that? Save this money, change that. And my boss, who was great, a lady called Lisa, was opposite me. And she just went, listen, right, stop. I'm going to give you an opportunity. Right, let's go and get you out of doing this and get you into designing answers and coming up with solutions and proposition development and, you know, kind of making things better. You know, because if you just go in and go, oh, everything's all right, it's fine. You know, you don't get anywhere, right? It's the same reason I went into the van world, looked at the van world electric wise, and it just wasn't going anywhere. There's nobody else saying it. I'm not happy. And people go, a surge of, you know, electric van registrations and, you know, doubling, da 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 da. It's still not enough.
It's still not.
And there's still a great gap of information and understanding and knowledge and all of those kinds of things. There's big challenges. We've got to focus on those, that level of discontentment, almost like, what could I have done better in anything, you know?
One of the big things is dealing with stress, I think, for most people. That's where they struggle. And some people say, like, how do you cope day to day in what you do? And I'm like, well, I'm not stressed. I just don't get stressed. But a lot of it's because I only stress about the things that I can change. There's so many things in your life that you cannot make any impact on. So why are you stressing about them? And there's one saying that always stuck with me from someone years ago I used to work with. He's like, if you worry, you die. If you don't worry, you still die. So why worry? Like, no matter what the situation is here, whether you're worrying or you're not, the end game is still the same outcome. So what's the point in worrying as you're going through life? You're not benefiting yourself in any way. So I'm just like, okay.
Chris, I mean, it leads us to that question. What do you want to achieve before you ultimately die? What do you want to
leave? Weird and far-fetched. So I say I want to get the charge cube stuff out there in volume to actually make a difference from that environmental impact world. Get that to a level where people are transitioning to electric and all that stuff. But then, you know, after Felton, I want to move into space tech. So I want to go to that next step then, which is, you know, quite a few years down the line, but I want to move into more in-depth design development, technology-based stuff, but for the next step, which is a space stuff. I think that's the next big thing after the EV stuff. And I think there's huge amount of stuff that can happen in that space. And it needs someone coming in to go, how do we do this more cheaply, more cost-effective? Like Elon's doing it with SpaceX, but who's doing that from a satellite point of view, from an other stuff point of view? So I think there's a big opportunity there that I really want to get involved with. But my focus once I want to move into space cleanup, not the opposite. So more, how do you deorbit stuff? How do you reorbit stuff? So it's not the same, but it's similar in that I'm sort of trying to do something which is environmentally beneficial in some
solving way. A potential future problem, aren't you? Because the space is getting quite cluttered, apparently. I didn't know that this was a thing, but there's actually a lot of stuff flying around in orbit.
It only takes
right?
one crash to stop us being able to exit the atmosphere. That's the worry. Is if you have one thing hit another thing, it breaks apart into loads of bits. And if that hits other things, you just end up with this massive cascading effect of parts flying around the Earth at well over 1,000 miles per hour. And if you're trying to exit and you've got those bits flying around, it doesn't go well. So there's definitely this big thing of going, well, how do you get some of that stuff out of the way? And how do you manage all of that stuff? So I have a lot of interest in that at the moment. Obviously, I'm focused heavily on Felton and the charge cube stuff right now. But longer term, that's always just ticking over in the back of my mind. And the AI stuff I'm doing a lot in at the moment. How is that thing of like AI annoys me because it's doing stuff for me, but at the same time, you just need to accept it and use it to your ability. So I'm trying to do that at the moment, trying to build up systems which I can put data in and then the staff can ask questions to it. So a full knowledge base of Felton, and you can ask it questions and it will respond with the answers, which has been a massive task because there's just no system out there that does it. So we've actually been building all of that from scratch in something called N8N, which is basically a software platform where you can build your own agent from start to finish. But that's going to allow a huge amount of first work to be taken away from me, because that data from my head is now stored somewhere else that other people can talk to when I'm not around. Yeah. So I'm trying to remove myself from some of these situations that I don't need to be used. I don't need, not needed in. And an AI can answer the questions on my behalf. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that's going to be a cool thing long term when you can build you can rebuild yourself in AI as such with your mindset. It's a weird thing to get people's head around, but long term, I think you will see like AI CEOs and stuff like that, which are sort of programmed based on data sets of previous CEOs and how they manage situations. And then the AI will be able to answer as if it was one of those CEOs. So one of the big things I'm doing with my AI is giving it a sense of humor and getting it to understand sarcasm and stuff like that, which is actually doing quite well. And some of my team have been coming to me going, how was it responding? So it's one that they're trying to get it to have sarcasm and understand that. It's been quite comical.
Very good.
Chris, for people who are out there listening to this, who hear AI and they just go into a cold sweat thinking, that's just going to take jobs away and that's a disaster and I'm not having anything to do with it. How would you encourage people to just take that difficult first step? Is it to look at ChatGPT straight away? Is it to go to Gemini? Is there some easy way in that people can say, I'm just going to give this a try and see?
So I find ChatGPT better than Gemini at the moment. But the issue with ChatGPT is your data is not secure. So be aware of that. Whereas Gemini with Google, it's all, anything you put in is secure data. So from business point of view, Gemini and the Microsoft stuff is better than from a safety point of view, from secure data, which is why we've done our own, because we want to have the data stored locally so no one else has access to it. But from a general playing around with AI, ChatGPT is probably the one to mess around with, but it's all about the prompts. It's all about how you structure your questions. If you can get your question structure correct, you'll get great outcomes, but you really need to get it to understand. Like, we do a lot of stuff around like English law and stuff like that when you're doing like stuff for HR. You have to tell it, we are based in England, this is the date, it needs to be based on these facts. Otherwise, you get a weird mix of stuff back, because you've got something that has so much knowledge based on, say, the internet, that there's so much miscommunication with it, you really need to try and fine-tune it. So it's trying to find uses for it, I suppose, that actually benefit you in work. And then it's that thing of how do you make it produce something that doesn't look AI written? Because that's becoming a thing. Okay? They just use AI. Like suddenly some of my staff emails have got amazing recently. I'm like, how have their emails suddenly gone from this to this? It's just they just hit a button on Google on the thing and it just says polish. Respond to this, polish, formalize. And suddenly it just adds loads of stuff. And you're like, that wasn't you that wrote that. You've written it, hit a button. So there's certain things around that where you're like, oh, what's going on? But I think what's going to happen soon is Apple were about to release their AI mixed in with Siri. And I think that will make a big difference, because you'll be able to just talk to it. I think the speech-based AI will become the big thing. I think typing it in long-term is going to become not a thing. I think everything is going to be just talk to it. It's going to be the most effective way of communicating, is just say something to it, it'll respond. So I think day to day, that's where you'll get to. Everyone uses Alexa and stuff like that as well. So as they get better, I think you'll naturally just talk to it and it will give you all the data right there and then instantly. So I think that's where AI is going to become a big thing. Jobs, it's, you know, if you look back at history, jobs get taken out all the time with new technology. All the time. Like the big one that people should really be worried about is not the AI, but they should be worried about the humanoid robot stuff that's developing, because that takes big physical jobs very quickly. Like AI is affecting one area, but you've got the humanoid robotics, which is affecting another area. So you're very soon going to hit a point where you're not needed anymore.
Well, but this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, we've heard about, you know, we won't get into the politics of it, but all of the tariffs and America trying to get their automotive industry back. But it was interesting. I was listening to somebody talk on that, and they were saying that, you know, in back in Detroit in the 60s and 70s, you know, there'd be 30,000 people employed to produce the General Motors, this or that, the Chevy, whatever, the Camaro or whatever. Now, if you were to bring it all back and do it, you'd probably end up with like 2,000 people, but they'd be producing twice the amount of stuff, you know. And it's like, well, the world has changed, right? In terms of the way we manage stuff, the way we do stuff, and it's always gonna change. It's gonna be interesting to see how we adapt as the human race to this sort of growth in tech. Have you got your head around that?
So I think you just look at the younger generation. We want to work. We have a certain mindset, depending on the age group, depends on how you look at the world. You look at the younger generation, a lot of them don't want to work, or they want to work 3-day week or 2-day week, or they want to work remotely. Like, actually, it's already started changing. The people that are struggling with it are the older generations. The younger generation are already accepting this as they're coming out of school. They know that it's going to change. It's going to change fast. I did a talk recently at a school, and it was talking about the new industrial revolution that's happening right now, and that every kid that leaves school will potentially have 4 to 5 careers in their lifetime. Most people, you know, that are 40 plus these days would have had one career in their lifetime. That's how they were programmed. Yeah. Now, younger generation, 4 to 5 careers in their lifetime. So I think that it's just the world's changing. The younger generations are already adapting to it quite quickly, and they've been brought up with rapid change. Like, I was at a weird point when I grew up where I remember the world without social media. And then when social media came in, I was sort of right on that part when I was a kid. So I know both sides of it. Obviously, the younger generations know no different and how fast things change. So they're used to it. They're, to them, it's just normal. But to us, it's more difficult, I think. So, yeah, I think it'll be fine. It'll probably help stabilize global politics and all that stuff over time as well, because everyone will be able to manufacture anything everywhere. And people maybe just need to step back and start enjoying life instead. You know, and traveling more. And like, I travel loads, and that's one thing that we try and do is travel a lot and see culture and stuff. So maybe it'll allow culture to come back. Maybe it will allow, you know, and I think that's going to be, so maybe actually people need to look at it slightly differently and be like, it might allow you to have more life experience and enjoy life itself rather than working all the time to live. It may allow a transition to happen, but, you know, and that may happen quite quickly. Maybe in the next 100 or so years, maybe, or maybe even quicker. The speed of literation with it is absolutely scary, but at the same time, it could be it yes. could be great, or it could be the absolute opposite.
I mean, I've said this a number of times. There was a great quote from a guy called Justin Trudeau, which is a long time ago, actually, probably 2018, 2019, where he said, "The pace of change has never been so fast." And it will never be as slow again, you know. And it's, you know, just the exponential rate of change. Anyway, on that point, we have a little tradition on the EV Cafe. And if you've listened to any of our other podcasts, you will know what is about to happen. I'm just looking to see if there's evidence that Chris has ever listened. No, he hasn't. Everybody, there is perfect evidence on Chris's face that he doesn't know what's about to happen. There we go. We won't hold it against him, but we will give you the same opportunity afforded to others. And it is to present you with...
Ooh.
And there it is, with the lightning bolt. There we go. So particularly poignant for...
Or the Felton.
Meaning... Felten, yes, the Felten, the lightning bolt. And it is a magic wand, Chris, and I'm going to hand it to you now. So there we go. It's coming to you. There you go. Through yes, there magic. You go. There you go. Good. So, Chris, you now have the magic wand. What one thing would you do right now with all of the stuff that's going on around you in your world, what one wish would you have to make a fundamental difference and move things forward for you, for the people around you, for the industry in general? You can use it any which way you like, but you only get one.
That's a deep question, isn't it? And problem is, in my head right now, I have this image of you in like a Harry Potter robe. At Universal Pictures, when you went and bought the wand, because you were blatantly one of the random people that you see at the thing going to the random lights and doing the...
It's been done. You're not denying it.
You're not denying it. It was blatantly.
It was sent.
Is it right, sent
to us by Benoit Laflamme because he'd listened to our podcast. Funnily enough, unlike you, and
let it go.
Let it go. And he sent us. He got these made. So and sent us. A magic wand. So anyway, there we go. That's the story behind it. I've never been to the Harry Potter shop, but Universal have bought 450 acres just down the road from me. But apart from that, yeah. It's close.
What was one thing I would change? As in globally? Just a general thing?
You can use your wish as you want. It can be as big or as little as you like. It's up to you.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, isn't it?
No idea. You got a million ideas.
There's just stupid amounts of ideas going on inside my head, unfortunately. I didn't know which one would be. I think for me, it's more going to be a global impact of... I was really hoping that with like all the European Union stuff, that suddenly we'd slowly get to a point where globally we would have one, I suppose, more entity, and that they're politically, they'd understand that manufacturing in China makes sense, because then you can keep the land really nice and pretty in these areas and not have to do manufacturing there. Like not doing manufacturing in the UK. We have great countryside. We have culture. We have, you know, all these amazing old buildings. Why do you want to start doing manufacturing there when there's a place in the world with very little going on that you can just manufacturing? So I'd really, in my head, I'd just love to see that more globally managed approach, that everyone has their specialities. and they are, you know, a bit like the human body has its key sections that work. You could do that globally.
Like,
unfortunately, I don't think it will ever happen until we colonize somewhere else. So once they get Mars colonized, the moon colonized, I think it will then change. Until that point happens, I don't think it will. Once you suddenly go, there's this other planet and they're potentially competition or something, you'll find once you, once human race gets out of this one planet thing and has multiples, you'll then treat everything as individual planets. Like you have countries, it will become planet-driven.
Yeah.
So I think it will happen, but I think it will take a very long time to happen. But for me, it would be great if everyone just accepted that these people are great at doing that thing, let them do that thing. These people are great. We do that generally in businesses. So why are you not doing it from a country level as such? Is to allow them to be great at their things they are great at and just accept you're not great at that thing and enjoy what you are great at.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's in my head. it's probably a bit too deep.
You know what, I love that.
But, yeah.
No, I love it. I think it's a great idea. And to pick up on the body and how we work as a, you know, folks, it's so important to recognize that we are all different. The neurodiversity thing, the whole bit. We all fulfill a role within society. Yeah. But what you're suggesting is let's elevate that to a point where, you know, wherever we're from in the world, we have our strengths and we have our weaknesses as individuals. And we should celebrate each other's strengths, celebrate our difference, and work together to deliver a global solution that is good for mankind as a whole.
I mean, look at it right now. Everyone's going, I don't want to manufacture in China. Let's manufacture in, say, India. So we want to be environmental. Let's now build all the same factories again and use all this concrete, do all this pollution in another place just because we don't want to buy from that place. Like, people insane or something. If you look at it just from an environmental level, it does not make sense. You have it all built there, working. You now want to do the same thing somewhere else, and then that one shuts down. It's just like, if you looked at it from an environmental point of view, you have one world, one Earth, you would go, that is mental. Why would you go and do that? You know? It's like you have a wound on one arm, I'm going to add one to the other one, just for the fun of it. It doesn't make sense. But obviously, you've got to remove all the political stuff from it and just look at it from it's not that easy, unfortunately. I wish it was. But yeah, it just seems crazy to me.
Well, great wish. And I think it really challenges our thinking. That's a great way to end. I mean, there was other things that I wanted to get into the arrival van, but I think you summarized that really well, but that won't go away. but as I reflect back on what you've kind of done with Felton, both from the fun side of it with creating something pretty, beautiful, enjoyable for individuals, you know, that want to convert this or that or the Mr. Bean vehicle. But also now sort of reflecting on the fleet area and what the challenges the fleet faces. You're trying to solve a problem of power and of getting energy into the right place at a reasonable cost and taking advantage of like the increase of second life batteries. And I hadn't known that difference in grade, battery grade before. So, you know, an 80 kilowatt hour battery from a Tesla is going to be infinitely better than a battery energy storage battery that's, you know, stuck on the side of your house type thing. And that's, it's really cool. And I think the cost return being over just a few years is also extremely good. And it could be quicker. So, I mean, Chris, this has been a really, not only fun, but a lot of real insight. And I love the idea of clearing up space. I mean, talk about kind of continually evolving. I mean, come on, what a joy. John, any final thoughts from you, buddy?
Yeah, I've got two. One is that my cheeks have never hurt from smiling quite as much as they have in the last hour and 9 minutes. And the other thought is, it's a bit like, we're a bit like three guys sitting in a pub, just having a chat, and it really genuinely does feel that we're on the same page, and that doesn't happen very often. So I think you're a very special person, Chris. I've never met you before, but I think we should recreate this in reality. Get a few pints in, 0 points for me, obviously, because I don't drink. Yes. But Guinness Zero, can I just say? Anyway.
Very good.
We should sit and just chew the fat for maybe a week.
A week. Chris would never manage it. His routine wouldn't allow it. Well, listen, guys, on that brilliant note, it's been a real joy, Chris. Thank you, for one, for your time, two, for your insight, and three, for just having a good time with us. We've had a really, really enjoyable time, as John has said. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what Felton will do in the future. And that's Felton, spelled F-E-L-L-T-E-N, meaning lightning in Welsh. You Google it, you'll find them. Definitely Google hazelnuts, hazel with two L's and nuts with a Z. Go and find the they'll be in the descriptions, so that you can follow hazelnuts and see the arrival van and the MX5. MX5 has had 700,000 views. The arrival van, I think, 400,000 views. These have really gone a long way, and really demonstrate that the innovation that Chris and the team are involved in is really interesting and exciting. And I did see the Mr. Bean Mini, all four wheels off the ground as well. Definitely a video worth watching, and a video to go and check out. So check them out, but follow Felton. And if the Charge Cube is of interest, you can reach out to us or directly to Felton, and we'll put you in touch there. You know, it's something that could really make a difference to your business, and deploy it in a day. Fantastic. Amazing. So with all that in mind, have a wonderful day, everybody, and thanks for being with us for today. And Chris Felton, CEO and co-founder of Felton. Have a great day, everybody.